You want to work it, or are you good to go? I haven't actually worked it, but lots of people got 3.4 in the last group.
Doesn't mean it's right.
Say again? How difficult is it to make? It's not particularly expensive. So liquid helium is expensive.
That's the one problem, only like that mixture of liquid and ice being left over. That would be like one other one problem with that glass. So if your temperature you find is not above zero, then you should suspect that there's something wrong.
Yeah, so if you get a negative temperature, then it's got to be wrong.
Yeah.
So you have to change your assumptions.
And what do you, can you go over the process of changing your assumptions?
So we're talking about the standard sort of problem, like this one where you put some ice in some water, and the question is, what's the final temperature?
Yep.
And the possibilities are that it's all water, and that, of course, means that the temperature is greater than zero. If you put in a whole lot of cold ice, it could be all ice, and the temperature would be less than zero. The other possibility is it's a bit of each, in which case the temperature is equal to zero. So if you make a wrong assumption, you'll get an impossible answer. So if you assume that it's all water in the final state, you will get a temperature that's less than zero if it's one of these two possibilities.
Okay.
Is it technically possible to have all water or all ice right at equilibrium temperature?
Sure, yep. In which case, all of these would give you the same answer. So this would give you exactly zero, and this would give you zero, et cetera. If this is the case, and you get a temperature that's greater than zero, then that's got to be nonsense. So the other possibility is temperature isn't the unknown in this situation, because we know the temperature is zero. So the unknown is how much mass melted. If more mass melted than was there, then you know that it can't be, right? So the mass has to be less than the original mass of the ice. If you think about it, there's another kind of crazy possibility, and that is that it could be negative and greater than minus the amount of water. Because the water could freeze, and we could, that is to say, almost all of this water could freeze, and we just have a little bit of leftover water. So as long as this is the case, then this is the solution.
So if I came across the ramen and I assumed it was all water and got an impossible temperature, I could go back, set my final temp equal to zero and solve for mass?
Yes.
Okay.
And if you got an impossible value for that, then you could assume that it stayed all, that it is all ice in the final state.
And then just change my mass to the entire...
So change the mass that solidified into minus the mass of the water. Yeah, so...
Where in the equation would you have the mass of the ice that's left over?
So if I thought that this was the situation, how would I work the problem? So what I'm going to have then is I'm going to start out with water that has some initial temperature, and it's going to go down to zero before it freezes. So this is going to be the mass of the water times the specific heat of the water. Then all of that water is going to freeze, and that's going to suck up heat. So it's usually we're thinking about things gaining heat, but this is going to be minus the mass of the water times the latent heat of fusion. And then that now ice is going to start at zero and go to some negative temperature T. Meanwhile, the ice started at some huge negative number, presumably, and it's going to end up at T. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So A hard part in all of this is figuring out what sign to use there. The MC delta T's are always the C of what it is now, and then final minus initial temperature. For this sign, you have to think whether this is going, whether this material is providing heat or whether it's eating heat. So it takes heat in order to melt ice or to boil water. And heat is going to be released if you go from vapor to water or from water to solid. I think you guys talked about these little packs that you can get, and you can make it solidify and they get hot.
Awesome.
I was given one of those packs by the chair, but I haven't. You have to boil them before they work, I guess. I haven't gotten around to doing that. Well, so I've got it. I just haven't boiled it.
Is there such a thing that you break it and then it makes it all go liquid and then it's cold? Like
I don't know. I haven't heard of that. Other questions? So. We've been talking about these calorimetry sort of problems, Q equals MC delta T sorts of problems. And the basis of all of these is conservation of energy. So the heat lost has to be balanced by the heat gained. And we have these equations for the heat change that you get. If you change the temperature, you're going to change the amount of internal energy. And the rate of that change is given by the specific heat. If you have a phase change, then you have a big change in the internal energy, all at the same temperature that it's occurring. So we're talking about internal energy, but in chemistry you tend to talk about enthalpy, which is almost the same thing. If you do your calorimetry at constant pressure, which you almost always do, then the heat that is gained or lost is a change in enthalpy as opposed to internal energy. If you do your calorimetry in what's called the bomb calorimeter that has a constant volume, then the heat that's given off is the change in the internal energy. And Gibbs free energy is known to everyone, and entropy is something that's in the future.
Just like 3 second cover, what's the difference between entropy and enthalpy again? It's been a couple
of years. So a huge difference. So these guys are all kind of the same thing, and they're all measured in joules or calories, and entropy has different units. So entropy is a measurement of disorder.
Right. And enthalpy is the
measurement. And enthalpy, Gibbs free energy, energy, those are all types of energy.
Okay.
And we'll talk more about entropy, I don't know, two or three lectures down the line.
I remember.
More questions? So what we're starting to talk about are heat engines. So we've got our heat engine here. Heat engines will learn to operate at temperature differences. So the head of this bird is kept cold by the water, and the bottom is kept warm. And basically how this heat engine works is by having heat at the bottom produce bigger vapor pressure for the material, so the pressure is bigger on the bottom than the top, so it pushes the water to the top where the thing tips over, and then the water can, it's not water, probably ether, can just drain out into the base. Okay, so in order to have such a heat engine, we need to have things operating at different temperature, and we need to have energy transfer. And so that's really the main topic today, heat transfer. So what we're talking about here, you've all seen these before, haven't
yes.
you? Okay.
My dad has one. I just think they're awesome. It's still awesome.
So you're told that you're not supposed to lick a pump handle, not that you've probably ever seen a pump handle, but you probably wouldn't hurt yourself if you pumped a wooden railing or something like that. So that difference between wood and iron is what we're talking about in having to do with heat transfer. And traditionally, we label three types of heat transfer. We've got conduction, we've got convection, and we've got radiation. So we talked a little bit about radiation last time, right, when we used this infrared thermometer. And we said that this thing can read the temperature of that wall by measuring the light that that wall is producing. It says it's about 19 C. So every object that has a temperature, which is every object, is producing an amount of light that depends on the temperature. And in fact, the amount of energy that it emits, of course, depends on how much area there is to do the emitting, and it depends very sensitively on the temperature. It depends on temperature to the fourth. So if you change the temperature a little bit, the wall is a lot brighter than it was before. We've got a, you know, kind of universal fudge factor, kind of like the Stefan Boltzmann constant, a universal constant that you can look up in the back of the book. And it turns out that not everything emits exactly the same. This is called a sigma, but the name of this constant is called the Stefan Boltzmann constant. I think it's FAN. I think I mentioned before Boltzmann is the guy who committed suicide before he could win his Nobel Prize. And Stefan was his major professor. So this E is the emissivity. It turns out that shiny objects don't emit light very well. And so they have a small emissivity. This emissivity would be zero for something that doesn't emit any light, and it would be one for the best possible emitter. And most objects have emissivities that are pretty close to one. So problems in the book have that being 0.95 or 0.92, numbers like that.
How does that gauge thing you have like negate the amount of light being reflected off of the object as opposed to what it's emitting itself?
So this thing could be fooled. If you made that object bright by shining light on it.
Oh.
But probably not fooled a whole lot.
So it'd be most accurate if we shut off all the lights and then pointed it at a
wall. Yeah, it should work just fine with the lights off. Won't be able to see the answer, but oh, it works perfect. I think actually it holds. Oh, it read zero. Let me make sure I'm using this thing right. Okay, so that it does hold. Okay. Now. Ah, 19, right? So it works with the lights off just fine. So you've all seen these sort of toaster things, which you can use electricity to change the temperature of. And as these things heat up, they start to produce visible light. They're always producing infrared light. And if I change the temperature a little bit, they get a lot brighter. And this thing is so hot that if I aim this thing at it, it basically goes off scale. We did that at the last section. But I got temperatures as much as thousands of degrees from it. Yeah. I can't see and push at the same time. So I get overloads from it, but I briefly got temperatures of over 1,000 degrees. So if you change the temperature, you get a huge change in the brightness. But even when you don't see it being bright, it's producing infrared light that this little box measures just fine. And of course, there's no fundamental difference between that toaster and your usual incandescent light bulb. The only difference is that the incandescent light bulb is enclosed, so it can go to higher temperatures before it melts or endangers your hands. Okay, so we're talking about the radiant energy that's produced by any object that has a temperature. It's produced according to the fourth power. The wavelengths of light that are produced also depend on the temperature as we go from something that is red hot to something that is white hot to something that is blue hot. Okay. Now, this is a great equation, but you always have some environment. And while that object is emitting light, also light from this room is going to be impinging on it. So energy from the room is going to be coming in. So the net energy loss from the device is going to be given by the difference in temperature of the object to the fourth compared to the temperature of the environment.
Okay, so which one's which?
So T is the temperature of the object, T naught is the temperature of the environment. So conduction. So this is the difference between various types of material, wood or the pump handle. And what this says is that the energy per second, the power, the thermal power that is produced depends, of course, on the area that you have of contact. And it depends on the temperature difference, and I'll just label delta T, between the two sides divided by the length of the object. And then we have a material constant that we would look up the way we've been looking up things from tables in our book that measure the thermal conductivity of the material. So here you see thermal conductivities of metal, thing that you don't want to put your tongue on. They're all pretty big, whereas thermal conductivity of wood is, you know, a hundredth as big, much less worry to go on. Okay, you can check out the units of this thing. We want to get out power, which is joules per second. That's the same thing as a watt. And what this says is if we take the area in square meters and multiply it by one of these thermal conductivities, which has the units of joules per second per meter per degree Celsius, and we multiply that by degrees Celsius per length, you can see these guys go away, those guys go away, and the power we're going to get out is in joules per second.
What are all the variables? So it's power and then...
So power is equal to the area that's doing that, that's in contact. Then this thermal characteristic that you would look up like in the CRC.
So it's a constant?
It's pretty much a constant for a material. So just like density changes a little bit with temperature, these thermal conductivities change a little bit with temperature.
Okay.
So you can, I guess it doesn't say, yeah, it does say that these are thermal conductivities at room temperature. But if you were to look up what the thermal conductivities are at 0 degrees Celsius, they'd be pretty much the same. And delta T is the temperature difference, and L is the separation of the material. I think it'll be clearer if we do a problem. Yes, question?
Nope.
So let's take a look at thermopanes. Is there an easy one here? Well, we'll suffer. There's an important fact that I need to get to do this thermopane problem, but let's start with it. So you know that these days, if you buy a window, it's not just a piece of glass. In order to conserve energy, they put a layer of air sandwiched between two pieces of glass. So in this particular problem, we're saying that we have one layer of glass that is half a centimeter thick, and another outer layer of glass that is also half a centimeter thick. And wedged between these guys, we've got air. And inside the house, it's 23 degrees. And outside the house, it's 0 degrees. And if we look up the thermal conductivities of these things, we have for the thermal conductivity of glass, it's 0.8. And for the air, this was 1 centimeter. For the air, it is 0.023. And it might be helpful to think about what the graph of temperature versus position is going to look like. So obviously, as we go towards the air, as we go towards the outside, the temperature is generally speaking going to go down. So we're going to have glass that is goes down at some certain rate. I don't want these to look the same. Some slope before we reach the outer temperature of 0 degrees. I really want these things to look different because they are. Different slopes in different materials. Do you believe that? Yeah, it's kind of hard to see. So that's the change in temperature with distance as we go from one side of the glass to the other. You're okay? So the temperature just inside, say, might be 21 degrees. Yeah, the slopes change. So let's take a look at what we have for the slopes. If we rearrange that equation, we have the power divided by the area times K. That has to be equal to the change in temperature per length. That is to say, the slope.
So the greater the slope, the better it is at insulating?
So, yeah, the greater the slope, the better it is at insulating. Yes. I guess I like to say it the other way around. The bigger the thermal conductivity, the smaller the slope. And that's why I tried to draw this flatter than that. And I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, but if something is highly conductive, then it doesn't take much of a temperature difference in order to produce a lot of power. Whereas if something is resisting, it's going to take a big temperature difference in order to drive that same power. So L is almost always the thickness of the material.
Okay. So it's not necessarily the distance between two contact points?
It is also the distance between these two contact points.
Okay, so the thickness of a given material. It's not like the 1 centimeter in between
it? It will be. The 1 centimeter. For air, it'll be this 1 centimeter.
L of air is 1 centimeter.
So then we have, for this problem, we have to calculate the difference in temperature between...
Yeah, it's not looking good, right? We don't know what the temperature is here and here.
Okay.
So in order to calculate how much heat is going through this pane, I seem to need what this temperature is.
Gotcha.
I'm not going to do it. You'll see that I have a trick. What is going to... So that's going to be the area that the heat is flowing through. It's going to be the size of this pane. You're good. If we're in equilibrium, then as much heat has to flow into this piece of glass as flows out. And as much heat has to flow out this pane as goes in this pane. So all of these powers per area, they have to be the same for all of these different materials. Right? So I can say that for the first material, for example, if I take the power divided by the area and the thermal conductivity of glass, I'm going to get the change, and multiply it by the length, I'm going to get the change in temperature for that piece.
Okay, so power, P equals power now, not pressure?
Yeah, okay. For a while. For the rest of this chapter. And then it comes back to being pressure again.
Just have like P sub something for pressure and then P sub something for power.
Well, so like economists like to put in lots of letters for their variables. So they might write out pressure or something like that. Say again?
That's why our economy is suffering. They don't understand what numbers are.
They're reckless in their use of letters.
No.
They should conserve letters. We should have letter conservation.
I totally agree.
Get rid of the Greek alphabet. Let's just use lowercase Latin alphabet.
Yeah.
In fact, let's just use A for everything.
Yeah.
Everything's X from now on. Okay, so we're not going to do that. So the change in temperature for that first piece is that, and I could similarly calculate the change in temperature for this piece. And I could calculate the change in the temperature for that piece. But if I add up all of those changes, I have to get the whole temperature change between the top and the bottom. Right? So this temperature change that I've calculated is this temperature change. If I do the next one, power times the length of the glass divided by the area and the thermal conductivity of glass, that's going to give me this temperature change. And finally, I have the third temperature change.
Wouldn't the thermal conductivity be the air, not glass?
I'm sorry, if I said glass, I was wrong. For two, it should be the thermal conductivity of air. So clearly, if I add up all of those things, if I add up the power, the length, the area, the thermal conductivity, that would be adding up all of those temperature differences, and that has to be the overall temperature difference 23 degrees. You okay? Okay.
Is this like actually for the answer, or are we just going over? Is this like to solve the problem, or is this just a clarification? I'm confused as to what we're finding.
So I think what you're saying is this seems like a lot of work for just a problem.
Yeah.
And we could have done this as kind of a general case before we worked the problem, but instead I'm kind of introducing this way of doing it as part of doing the problem. So,
okay.
Yes, we'll have to do this lots of times
okay.
in working these problems.
And that, if you do the little segments by segments, that gives you the overall change in temperature?
If we add up all of these temperature differences, we're going to get the overall temperature difference.
Okay, and that's 23?
And that was 23 in this particular problem, because
okay.
it was 23 on the inside and 0 on the outside. So, I mean, if we wanted to, we could write that as a separate equation, that the power divided by the area, that's a constant, so I could pull it out. The lengths divided by the thermal conductivity, that's the overall temperature change for the whole device. So this combination happens commonly enough, length divided by thermal conductivity, that this is sometimes called the R factor. So if you go to Fleet Farm and buy insulation for your house, you'll see that they're rated by the R factor of the material. Unfortunately, it's English R factor, so it's in something like BTUs per square foot degree Fahrenheit, as opposed to good metric units. But either way, this is the same thing as the R factor for the insulation that you would buy. Okay, so finally I'm set up to calculate the power that's going through this window pane. So the power per area is going to be the full whole temperature change divided by add up the lengths divided by the thermal conductivity. Yes?
How can you then pull out PA? Wouldn't the area be different for the glass and the air?
No, because we're talking about, you know, sheet after sheet after sheet. So the inside area, the outside area of the pane is exactly the same as the inside area of the pane.
The total area.
Yes, that's the only area there is. So we're not talking about something that has to do with the thickness of the pane. We're talking about the whole side of the mirror, of the piece of glass.
Okay.
So all of those areas are the same. All of those powers are the same because the same stuff is going through each one of those layers.
Okay.
Sure. Last class asked me to turn off the bouncing head. So. Okay, so we're all set. We've got a temperature change that is 23 degrees. We've got a thickness of glass that is half a centimeter. And we've got the thermal conductivity of glass, the 0.8. We've got the 1 centimeter of air. And we've got the other sheet of glass. So we're all good then to calculate the power. The area was nicely 1 square meter. Okay, so we got the 0.05 divided by 8, and we're doing that twice. And we've got the 1 centimeter and 0.0234. Add all those things up. Divide them into the 23, and I get 52.3. What? Joules per second, right? Which are the same thing as watts.
Are we solving for power in this case?
Yeah, so I actually multiplied through by the area, which was 1. The problem says that the area is 1. Okay, so then the problem says if you don't buy a thermal plane, instead you buy just a big piece of glass, thick piece of glass, then how much power is gonna leak out the window? So for part B, we got a single 1 centimeter thick piece of glass, 1 square meter. How much heat is going to be lost? Well, that's an easier problem, right? So we have then that the power is the area times the thermal conductivity, the change in temperature divided by the length. The area is still 1 square meter. The thermal conductivity of glass is 0.8. The temperature change is 23 degrees, and that's over 1 centimeter. So we got 23, 0.01, 0.8. No reason to multiply by 1. Seems bigger. Nope, same number I got before. So this turns out to be 1,840 watts. So there's a huge difference in the energy that's going to leak out through a piece of glass compared to one of these thermal panes.
They've made storm windows first.
I don't know. These days, pretty much everything is going to have an air layer. And actually, usually it's an inert gas like argon, I think, as opposed to air. Or is it nitrogen? I forget. You don't really worry about heat loss from vehicles, because you can always just, you got a lot of heat production from your engine for free. Let's take a look at 61. So we didn't need to calculate those temperature changes. In this problem here, they're actually asking us what the temperature change is, the temperature at this junction. So here we've got 80 degrees, 30 degrees, we've got gold on one side, we've got silver on the other, and we're supposed to figure out what the temperature is at the junction. And they don't give us any dimensions. And I don't know if that makes sense or not. If you stretch out this thing, it's still going to kind of average out the same. It doesn't matter how long it is, it doesn't matter how fat it is, you're going to have the same temperature in the middle. So if we look at the thermal conductivities, we find out that silver is more conductive than gold. So what's the temperature, roughly speaking, what's going to be the temperature at this junction? Kind of the average temperature is 55. Is it going to be higher or lower than
60?
It's going to be higher than 55.
No, 50, because silver is more conductive.
Yeah, yep. So a smaller temperature difference will put the same amount of heat through the silver as through the gold. So we're thinking that a number less than 55 should be the right answer. Okay. Well, once again, we have the statement that the same amount of heat has to flow through the gold as through the silver. So our setup here is we've got equal lengths of gold and silver. And the gold was, anybody remember, 317? The gold was 314, and the silver is 427. So we don't know the area, and we don't know the length. We do know that it's the same area and the same length for each bar. So the power that's going through the gold would be the area times the thermal conductivity of gold times the unknown temperature change. So that's from 80 to some unknown temperature T, divided by whatever that length is. And that same amount of power going through the same area but with different thermal conductivity has to be the power that's going through the silver. And notice that the A's go away, the L's go away. So that's why they didn't tell us those quantities. That it doesn't matter. Whether we stretch this out, whether we make it fat, the temperature at the junction is going to be the same. So what we've got then is the equation that the thermal conductivity of the gold times the temperature difference of the gold has to be the same as the thermal conductivity of the silver times the temperature difference of the silver.
If you didn't know that the areas and lengths canceled, could you not essentially like as constants as long as you did the same for both? Would you still get the same answer?
Yeah, sure. If you put in a particular value that's the same, it's going to work out the same. Okay, so let's put the minus thing on this side of the equation and that minus thing on that side of the equation. So I'm going to get the thermal conductivity of the gold times this 80 plus the thermal conductivity of the silver times the 30. That has to be the thermal conductivity of the silver times T plus the thermal conductivity of the gold times T. And we can factor out that T, so we get the sum of the thermal conductivities all times T. So the temperature we can calculate then as the thermal conductivity of gold times its initial temperature plus the thermal conductivity of silver times its final temperature divided by the sum of those thermal conductivities. And we're expecting a number that's going to be less than 55. So the gold is 314 and we've got 80. And the silver is 427 and we got 30. And then we've got the 314 and the 427. And I get 51.2. And since I started with Celsius, I'm going to get Celsius, right? Good. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the Stefan-Boltzmann equation problems. No, I don't know. So here you are nude in a room that has a temperature of 20 degrees, pretty much room temperature. Now you know that your body temperature is 37 degrees, but your skin is at a slightly lower temperature. They're saying 33 degrees. And they're saying that you have a surface area of 1.5 square meters, right? I guess it depends on whether you're trying to make yourself into a small ball or not. And we're supposed to figure out what the rate that the energy is that's radiated from your body. So that's just a plug and chug. We had that the energy loss by radiation was the emissivity times the area times the Stefan-Boltzmann constant times the temperature of the object to the fourth minus the temperature of the environment to the fourth. So the emissivity is stated to be 0.95. It's usually something close to 1. They're claiming that your surface area is 1.5 square meters. The Stefan-Boltzmann constant, you can look up on the back cover of your book. It's 5.67 times 10 to the minus 8. And the temperature is 33, so we cube that. And the environment is 20, so we cube that. No, yeah, we have to have absolute temperature, right? So the 33, we need to add the...
What does the V stand for?
Emissivity. There was a question here, though.
Does it need to be in Kelvin?
Yes, the T absolutely has to be in Kelvin. So when don't the T's have to be in Kelvin? So I could tell you, I think it's the wrong message, that you can always convert and you won't hurt yourself, that always using Kelvin is safe. But, you know, it seems like a lot of work. Anytime we have temperature differences, it doesn't matter whether that temperature difference is in Kelvin or in degrees Celsius. It's going to be the same. So when we're dealing with temperature differences, that's when we can use degrees Celsius without worrying about it. And with the Q equals MC delta T, it's always been the case. With this thermal conductivity, it was delta T divided by L. So ideal gas law, where we had a raw temperature, this where we have a raw temperature, we have to have absolute temperatures.
So, okay, so it's technically not the change, though, even though it's...
Well, it's to the fourth.
Okay.
So it is not true that t to the fourth minus t naught to the fourth is equal to t minus t naught to the fourth.
Okay.
If it were true, we could do it, but it's not true.
So if it were like the all of it to the fourth, that would be like,
yes. If we had an equation that had that, we could do it in Kelvin, we could do it in Celsius, it wouldn't matter. Because the temperature difference between those two would be exactly the same. Okay, so this guy is 306. And 20 degrees added on to, it is 20 degrees. Yeah, 20 degrees added on to 273 is 293. I don't know if you can read that or not. So we got 0.95, we got 1.5, we got this extremely small stuff on Boltzmann constant. Seems like we're going to get a pretty small number out, but 306 to the fourth is a huge number. I have basically more than a billion. And the 293 to the fourth, also billions. So I subtract it, I get billions. And I multiply it through, and I get 113 watts. Okay, so that's a noticeable amount of energy. So your basic metabolism rate is around 50 watts. So you have to turn up the engine a little bit to sit nude in this room temperature room. Here?
Yeah.
I told you stuff that wasn't true, so don't remember it.
Where did those t to the fourths come from?
Wait.
Because originally the equation was just the t.
No, it's always been t to the fourth.
Oh, I guess I just saw it.
Stefan.
T to the fourth minus t naught.
Yes, to the fourth.
Okay. We had it on the other side where radiation.
Why did you? Did you erase something that wasn't true, but like, why did you?
So the question is, when can you use Celsius and when do you have to use Kelvin? And when you've got temperature differences, then you can use Celsius. And so the question was, don't I have temperature differences? And it may look like differences, but it's differences to the fourth.
Oh, to the fourth, so you need to have Kelvin.
You need to put the Kelvin in, yep.
And then also, what is supposed to be the equation for convection? I don't know if we have written it yet or if we've run them.
So, this is the equation for convection.
Excellent. Cool.
So, convection depends on, so I guess I haven't defined convection. So, kind of the classic example of convection is something like a candle flame. So, how a candle flame works is it sucks in air and heats it up and hot air rises. And so, we have this automatic transfer of energy by sucking in some material, heating it up, and spitting it out. So anytime you do that, get material hot and then move it, that's certainly heat transfer and it's convection, but the precise process depends on a whole lot of complicated fluid mechanics. So there isn't an equation for convection. There are various approximations that engineers would use to predict it, but just as so typically if you have convection, it's not laminar, it's turbulent. So usually you have some sort of turbulent flow problem.
So I'm assuming we're not going to worry about it.
There is no equation in our book for the convective losses. More questions? Okay, so here's the beer in the styrofoam box problem. So what we've got is, you know, one of these little styrofoam boxes. They say that it has a surface area that's 0.8 square meters. We're going to put in 5 kilograms of ice. That's about 10 pounds of ice, so it's not an unreasonable amount of ice. And they claim that it takes 8 hours for that ice to melt. And this is with the inside temperature being 5 degrees Celsius and the outside temperature being 25 degrees Celsius. And we're supposed to figure out what the thermal conductivity of the styrofoam is. So this is thermal conductivity, so it's the same old equation. The power is equal to the area times the thermal conductivity times the change in temperature divided by the thickness. So we've got power. They tell us that the area is 0.8 square meters. We're supposed to figure out what the thermal conductivity is. They tell us that the temperature difference is 25 minus 5, or 20 degrees Celsius. And they tell us that the thickness of the styrofoam is 2 centimeters. So if we knew the power, we'd be all set. Right? We'd have just one unknown, namely the thermal conductivity. So the energy that's being released is the latent heat of fusion of the ice. So the energy, that's equal to the mass of the ice times the 3.33 times 10 to the fifth. Right? That's the number of joules that we have stored as heat in the ice. The time, we're told, is 8 hours, and an hour has 3,600 seconds. So the number of joules per second that the ice is putting out, which is the power, is given by that equation. So we've got the 5 kilograms times the 3.33 and our exponent 5. We're supposed to divide that all by 8 and by 3600. And what I get is basically 60 watts. Yes.
You said that's another equation, power equals energy divided by time.
Yes, that's always that's been an equation for a long time. You don't remember that one, huh?
So,
we use small case t for time.
Yes, we really should. Yep. We can even write out time and energy. That's what the energy is, right? It's heat energy that's stored in that ice.
Okay,
so we can calculate the thermal conductivity, right? We've got the 58 watts. We need to divide it by the 0.8 and the 20 degrees Celsius and multiply it by the 0.02. And what I get is a thermal conductivity that is 0.072. And the units are going to be watts per square meter per degree Celsius and meter on the upstairs. So watts per meter degree Celsius, just like all of those other thermal conductivities.
Do you have any ideas? Like, honest to God, why'd you go all the way upstairs?
Ah!
Good effort, but it's been 5 years.
Okay, so let's take a look at one of these trickier problems. So 66 is a nice red problem. We haven't done many red problems. That's actually 66. Doesn't look like it, but it is 66. So the problems are coded with their difficulty in the book. So there are black problems, there are blue problems, and there are red problems. They're supposed to be the hardest.
It's code red.
Red means stop. It's don't do this problem.
You don't want to do this problem?
I'm kidding. No.
What's interesting about this problem is that it actually has us calculate an R value the way you would look it up in at Fleet Farm. So the hypothesis is that we have a wood-fired stove, and they tell us the dimensions of that stove, and they say that it's going to operate at 400 F. And we want to use that stove to keep the inside of our house at 70 degrees Fahrenheit even when the outside is at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. They give us the dimensions of the wall, and we're supposed to figure out what the R factor is that's required in order to keep the house toasty warm. So, I mean, kind of theoretically, it's not super hard. We know the power produced by that stove. We could calculate by the area of that stove, Stefan Boltzmann constant, its temperature minus the ambient temperature to the fourth times this emissivity. And we know that that same, so this is the area of the stove. We know that that same power is going to leak through the walls. So there's going to be the area of the walls times the thermal conductivity of the material times the change in temperature. And this is going to be the 70 degrees minus the 32 degrees divided by the thickness of the material.
How do you know to use both equations for this in this case?
Because we have to be in thermal equilibrium, which means that the energy produced by the stove is leaking out through the walls.
And then, so then these equations are used for two separate things. So like what is the one with the stove referring to?
So this is, the way the stove is heating is by radiant heat.
Okay.
So the stove is radiating light, infrared light, and that's what's heating the house.
Okay.
That's the source of energy, and this is the rate that it's disappearing from the house. All right, so we could ask a similar question. If a cat produces 25 watts of energy, how many cats does it take to heat the house? Probably more than you want, but... Yeah, so we'd have n cats, solve for n. So remember that this quantity here, that was the resistance factor, the R factor. So this is the area times the change in temperature divided by the R factor of the wall. And R factors are in crazy units of BTUs per hour per square foot.
It's a BTU.
So a BTU, so just as there's a calorie per gram degree, that is to say people when they started out were thinking about nice units. So a BTU is the amount of heat it takes to raise 1 pound of water, 1 degree Fahrenheit.
Okay.
So it stands for British Thermal Unit. And it's, they don't use it. I mean, we're the only ones who use these crazy units. And this is kind of the worst possible case, right? BTUs per hour, per square foot, per degree Fahrenheit. I mean, yuck. Okay, but so to start this problem, what we're going to need to do is to get the temperature in absolute degrees. And so at least what I would do is to convert the Fahrenheits to Celsius and then the Celsius to Kelvin. Okay, so we have 5F minus 9C equals 160 is kind of how I recommend doing this. And we're told that the Fahrenheit degrees are 400. So if we rearrange this, we have 5 times 400 minus 160 is 9C. So the Celsius degrees are 5 times 400 minus 160 divided by 9. Okay. So and of course the reason I'm converting this is because we only have the Stefan Boltzmann constant in Kelvin degrees. So I can't use Fahrenheit. Why I would want to, but I'm unable to use Fahrenheit for that. And what I get is basically 200C. So if I add 273.15, I get a Kelvin temperature that is 477.6.
Wait, how does that work if you were at 200 Celsius? Don't you just add 273?
So it'd be 470.
473 then?
Is it 204 actually?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so it's 273.15.
It's but the original temperature is.
So this was only approximate value. Right? It was a little bit, I guess, more. Okay, so we could do the same thing to that temperature. I don't think we're going to get to the end of this problem. So we could do that to that temperature. We can get the power output that we have in joules per second. So we're going to have to convert that to BTUs per hour. If you look in the front cover of your book, you'll find nice conversion factors, and they have one for joules per second to BTUs per hour. It's the very last one. So what we're going to get then is so many BTUs per hour, and we know what the temperature difference is in degrees Fahrenheit. We know what the surface area of the house is, so we can solve for the R factor. And I will tell you, if I can find my glasses. So in order to get the R factor the way it is in Fleet Farm, we have to use English units. And so the R factor is defined in terms of BTUs per degrees per. So I get 7.8. So that's square feet per degree Fahrenheit per BTU per hour. Wasn't worth doing. No. So I will never have you do
okay.
Something like that.
Yeah.